welcome to a Final Four edition of Teal Time with David Teal. I'm Jonathan Heater alongside David Teal. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning.
This probably isn't your first Final Four.
No. I believe it's 26 or 27.
That is a lot. Are there a couple that stand out for you?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Give me three.
Okay. You always remember your first, right? Yeah. 1983, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Jim Valvano.
We talked about that last week.
Yeah, run around the court like a crazy person trying to find somebody to hug. And I teased last week a story about that first Final Four, and I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. But after the national championship game, it's historic. You know, Wittenberg's air ball, Lorenzo Charles dunk, Cozell McQueen standing on the rim, everybody's going crazy. Well, the press room at the Pit in Albuquerque was almost an outdoor tent. It was kind of removed from the arena. They had a setup in there, and this was back in the day where your computer was tied to electricity, and no batteries. Not once, but twice, the power went out in the press room. And when the power went out, you lost what you had written. And you're on deadline. And one of my mentors in this business, Bill Millsaps, former columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and I was in a lot of press rooms and a lot of press boxes with Saps, and I never saw him lose his cool except this night. He was furious. And I'm not even 24 years old yet. And I'm scrambling. And I'm calling my office. And basically, we decide I'm going to have to dictate. I'm not going to have a chance to write. I'm going to have to just dictate off the top of my head. And you know, you're thinking, okay, you know, this has got to be great. I've got to do this event justice. This is going to be in my clip file. I'm going to use this to get great jobs in my future. And this is when I'm working for the Fayetteville Times in North Carolina. And I get home from the Final Four day later, and I pick up the paper, and whoever took dictation misspelled Albuquerque in the dateline. Well, that wasn't such a good clip, now was it?
No, because there's no way you could fault someone else for that.
Like, no!
You know, they see the clip and they're like, this idiot it's messed up from the very start.
Yeah, couldn't even spell Albuquerque.
All right, so I have a couple questions.
Sure. That's my first Final Four, and there'll be others we can mention.
Okay, so since this is a little bit before my time in newspapering, generally viewing of television, was that... Were Final Fours back then aired live?
Yes.
And so did they, so that had an East Coast time start, or did it start?
Oh, no, it was late.
So.
No, it was late, big time.
So then it helped in our older deadline system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Deadline was probably, I don't know, 11:30 or midnight.
Yeah.
In that range. But no, it was televised live. And to show you how times have changed, the West Regional was in Ogden, Utah. And NC State beat Ralph Sampson in the West Regional Final. Ralph Sampson's final collegiate game. NC State wins to complete this magical run to the Final Four. The Wolfpack may not have even gotten in the NCAA tournament had it not won the ACC tournament. And so I just went from Ogden to Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. Didn't even come home. And Valvano...
Did you drive that or did you fly?
No, I flew. Valvano would hold court with us every morning at NC State's hotel, very informally down in the lobby.
Oh, have times have changed.
Yes, exactly. You could never have that today. And I'll never forget, we were sitting around, just a handful of us with Valvano. And the night before, some buddies and I had gone to see Huey Lewis in the News at some joint in Albuquerque. Well, Huey Lewis walks through the lobby. So me and my buddy get up to go say hello to Huey and say, great show last night. And Valvano goes, no, back here. I'm the show now. And he was.
That's one of those. I'm guessing back in that time, the coaches that did that, it more often than not they would do that than not do that, right? That they would sit around with beat writers and just chat for as long as you wanted, probably.
Yeah, because there wasn't the media demand
right
back then, and Valvano was a young coach and he was still building a program and he wanted all the attention and visibility that he could get, and he was a showman. He could not resist the spotlight, never could.
And there wasn't the fear of everything they said would end up on television,
right? Or in a podcast or on Twitter,
right.
Or
right.
No, anything like that.
So this leads me to a bunch of other questions.
Okay.
Obviously, there are moments that we, as sports writers, we cover that we know in the moment that we're seeing history.
Yes.
As a 22, 23-year-old, I mean, as a 23-year-old, I covered the Tiger Woods Masters where he chipped in on 16 at Augusta. You're talking about the NC State-Houston championship game, mm-hmm. where you know something big is happening.
Yeah.
And it can be a little overwhelming.
It's a lot overwhelming.
Well, but you start, and if you could put it out of your mind in the moment, you don't think that, hey, this is going to be in the historical record forever. Yeah. People could be going and looking at this for 100 years in microfilm, or whatever exists in the future.
Yeah.
So what point in your career did you get past that where you had the confidence just to, whatever the situation was, you were fine?
I don't think you ever get past that. Even a big event or a big story where someone has shared so much and you're trying to craft a profile or such, I can't tell you how many times I have said to my wife or a friend or a coworker, I just want to do it justice. I don't want to screw this up. And yeah, sometimes that gets to you. Just have to exhale and say, okay, been here, done this. But if you don't have that anxiety and you don't have that desire to do it justice, then I think, you know, maybe you've kind of lost that edge. At least that's the way I operate.
It's the same thing you think as having butterflies before a big game as a player.
Sure, as an athlete. Absolutely.
You know, I always marvel at the AP guys. Paul Newberry's a guy I worked alongside a lot. He's an AP National College Football writer.
Yeah,
based out of Atlanta. Yeah, and I marvel at those guys it's almost like a machine level of consistency. They go, as soon as the game ends, they're good. It doesn't matter. But there's also the part where you're talking about. You know, and it's different when... It's different, the historical moments that you expect. So Hank Aaron's record-breaking home run. Yeah. You know there's a chance he's going to hit it, and mm-hmm. you have time to think about you know, how you're going to craft that. But the unexpected, you know, if Duke makes that, or if Butler makes that half-court shot, Gordon Haywood makes that half-court shot and beats mm-hmm. Duke, I mean, and you have, people don't realize, you have maybe 45 minutes to write that story.
Yeah, a little daunting.
All right. Two other Final Fours that you really remember.
91, when Duke beat Vegas in the semifinals. Yeah. Vegas is undefeated.
Uh-huh.
They are going to win back-to-back national championships. They had destroyed Duke in the 90 final in Denver by mm-hmm. 30 points. And Duke comes into Indianapolis, a clear underdog, but yet keeps it close. And then Bobby Hurley hit the most cold-blooded three you can ever imagine to put them ahead for... It wasn't the first time in the game, but it was the first time in a while. And you could almost see the look on Larry Johnson, Stacy Augmon, and the rest of those Vegas kids. They're like, oh, crap. We haven't really been in this tight situation before. What are we going to do? And Duke, you know, then Leitner hit some free throws late to salt it. And, you know, the buzzer goes off, and there's, again, you feel this sense of history. Oh my gosh, Duke has beaten the giant Vegas. And you look, and there's Krzyzewski on the bench, calming everybody down, going, whoa, 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 one more game. I mean, immediately, he's one more game, pointing ahead to Kansas. Because in the first game of that Final Four semifinal Saturday, Kansas and Roy Williams, its fairly new coach, had just beaten North Carolina, his alma mater, and his mentor, Dean Smith. And Dean had been ejected from the game for a second technical foul late by an official named Pete Pavia. So Duke, Carolina, Kansas, Roy, Dean, Krzyzewski, Vegas. You talk about an overwhelming Saturday. That's as good a semifinal Saturday as you could have imagined.
And that UNLV team is one of the more, one of the more memorable runs of any, you know, I know back then they were a power team, right, but outside of one of the big conferences, I mean, over a 2-year span, would they lose one game, two games?
Yeah, their national championship team, I believe, lost twice, perhaps, during the regular season. But no, they were great, and they pressed you, and they defended as well as you can imagine.
And that was Kay's first championship, right?
Yeah, and then they repeated in 92.
Because of the Leitner shot that got them there, right?
Yes, and I was there for, that was the East Regional Final in Philadelphia against Kentucky.
We're talking about unexpected drama.
Yeah, well, that's when, and Dave Fairbank, our former co-worker, was with me in Philadelphia that day. And when Leitner hit that shot, first of all, when Sean Woods hit the shot for Kentucky, that ridiculous bank in the lane to put Kentucky ahead by one in overtime with 2.1 seconds to go, I happened to glance over my shoulder, and there's Krzyzewski's oldest daughter standing up, and tears are just streaming down her face. It's over. They're not going to repeat. And then Leitner hits the shot, and I turn back around, and there she is, and she's still crying. She's so happy. And I grabbed Fairbank, and I said, I hope you understand what we just saw. It's the greatest college basketball game ever.
Have you ever seen a better one?
No. No, given the stakes and the ending and just the overall quality of play that entire game, absolutely not.
It's funny, there are moments like, You could see that picture or that video of Thomas Hill.
Yes.
And you see everything that you need to know about the emotion of that game. Same thing with Valvano. You don't have to see anything that happened. No. Just see him running around.
Right.
It's what makes that tournament so good.
And the cool thing, Krzyzewski has this ability to put the immediacy of the result aside and to have the wherewithal to go to the Kentucky Radio Network. I believe it was, what was it, Kaywood Ledford, he was the legendary Kentucky broadcaster, and was, I think it was his final game. But Krzyzewski went over there to go on the air with the Kentucky radio crew to salute the Wildcats. And the job that Rick Pitino had done, and, you know, he had brought them back from probation and the whole Eddie Sutton fiasco. And to just have that composure and not to be just about Duke and, yeah, we're going back to the Final Four, it was remarkable.
All right, number three.
Another
to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. You know, I was there for Dean's second one when Weber called the infamous timeout that he didn't have in New Orleans. But, you know, going back to San Antonio this week for the Final Four, I go back to Bill Self's championship there when Mario Chalmers hit that three to force overtime. Because Memphis and Calipari, they're going to win.
Yeah.
And even though they bricked all that, they gave Kansas every chance to come back, and Chalmers comes down and hits that shot. And I remember Andy Petrini, who still works here with us, She was on the desk, and we were up against deadline and regulation. And again, it was one of those holy cow moments. Now what? And she's like, we're going to be okay. I think we've got a few more minutes. And this is when we weren't writing just for the web. We were trying to get this puppy in print. And it was crazy. And then fortunately, at least for us on deadline, Kansas took control pretty early in overtime. And you kind of knew so you could start, okay, Chalmers, Kansas, they're going to win.
Why do you think that shots like the Lorenzo Charles stick in or the Leitner shot hold these spots in history? But and maybe it's the prisoner of the moment thing, but I don't feel like maybe Chalmers' shot or even the Jenkins shot, which won a national championship, mm-hmm. have the same emotional... Is it just because of our age and it harkens back to a different era? Why do you think the immediacy of these other shots that are arguably just as big as those shots aren't remembered the same way?
I think with Leitner, if he misses, they lose. Mm-hmm. And with and it's a good point about Chalmers, because if he misses, they lose. But it didn't win the game. There were still five more minutes to play, so I think that's part of why Leitner's shot really really sticks out, or Charles's shot, because they or even Jenkins, because they ended it right there, and then you know Jay Wright just going bang.
Yeah,
I mean, you can read his lips there. Now, I wasn't at that Final Four, but to just see it on TV was like, wow.
Or if Gordon Hayward makes that shot, I mean, that's the all-timer right there, right?
Yes, it is. And Krzyzewski is second guest from now until the end of time for having, who was it? I forget who it was, intentionally missed the second free throw. Mm-hmm.
We could probably chat about this stuff for hours.
Oh, yeah.
And as basketball ends, maybe we'll come back to this topic for some evergreen stuff.
There was great. I mean, even you know Duke repeating in 92 and Krzyzewski beating first Bob Knight, his mentor, then the Fab Five, which I think we're going to talk about here in a little while because I've got some notes on that as we talk about the current Duke team that lost to Kansas on Sunday night. But, I've been blessed. Some of the great moments. Joaquin Noah for Florida when they won their first national championship in Indianapolis nearly put his foot through my laptop because at the end of the game he comes jumping up on the press table to mm-hmm. get up there.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and it's
you.
It's me, and I had to pull my laptop out, or literally his size, whatever.
Probably 18.
Yes, was going right through the keyboard, dude.
That's a different deadline situation.
Yes. Hello, boss.
Dictating in, what, 2007, 2008, whatever that was. All right, let's get to this year's Final Four.
Absolutely.
All right, so I guess the narrative probably is that there is a JV semifinal and a varsity final.
Well, and that takes me back to my first Final Four because that was the narrative back in 83. NC State and Georgia was the JV game, and then it was Louisville and Houston in this incredibly athletic up and down, this is going to determine the national championship, and clearly it did not because NC State then turned around after beating Georgia and beat Hakeem Olajuwon and Benny Anders and company. But it, as much as, you know, Kansas-Villanova seems like the varsity game, first of all, Michigan's a 3-seed.
Mm-hmm. We both picked them to be in the Final Four.
Yeah, Big Ten tournament champion. Not John Beilein's first rodeo. I mean, his record is a NCAA tournament coach. I believe he's 23 or 24 and 11.
He's sleepy great. I don't think he's considered one of the better coaches in college basketball. This could be a second national championship game.
Yeah, he is by those who understand the game. I mean, that's a guy who won at Canisius. Mm-hmm. He won at Richmond, and then he won at his alma mater, West Virginia, and now he's doing great things at in Ann Arbor. So, you know, JB gave me, and I get the Loyola presence, but, you know, Loyola, we've watched him enough now to understand. I believe they've only lost 5 games mm-hmm. this season. They're good. I mean, Ingram and Richardson and Towns, I mean, they're good players.
Yeah, I thought I said last week, I thought they had a chance to get to the, I thought they had a decent chance to get to the Final Four, and they're reminiscent of some of those Butler, George Mason, VCU teams. Yeah. And it's a very good basketball team.
No,
they probably should have been ranked at the end of the year.
Well, they were, I think.
Oh, were they?
Yeah,
were
I believe
they?
So. And it was funny, Norm Wood, our co-worker, actually tweeted, kind of patting himself on the back, that he and one other guy had Loyola ranked the highest in the final AP poll. Norm had him 20, I believe. And then I tweeted back at him, but did you pick him to beat Miami in the NCAA tournament? And he was like, quit ruining my narrative, bro.
I did think they could beat Miami.
I did, too. I picked him to beat Miami.
And if you were going to pick a double-digit seed, a mid-major, to make a run, they probably would have been the one you'd pick.
Yeah. I mean, coming from a quality league like the Missouri Valley, which has produced, you know, Wichita State previously as a Final Four, four squad, the Shockers left the league and now they're in the American Athletic Conference. But no, I mean, Missouri Valley's been an excellent conference for a long time, one of the best mid-majors. And Doug Elgin, their commissioner, is the former SID at Virginia back in the Ralph Sampson days. Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
They brutalized Kansas State. I mean, it was not...
It was not close.
Not close. And, I mean, you know, Kansas State's a 8 seed or are they 9 seed?
9
seed. I mean, so they're unexpectedly in this position, too. Mm-hmm. They probably thought if they won, they'd get Virginia and, you know, Kentucky, Arizona, and Kentucky finally, I mean, that inexperience and youth caught mm-hmm. up with them. If I thought going into the weekend that Loyola had a pretty good shot to get there. But, you know, I still would have, I think we both thought Kentucky probably was going to be the team that made it out of that, mm-hmm. out of that region.
Yeah, I did, but you're right. Their youth caught up to them, much as it's much, much different. Duke and Kansas played a classic regional final
mm-hmm.
Sunday night. And if Grayson Allen's shot goes in, obviously, at the end of regulation, Duke's in the Final Four. The narrative is totally changed about a team with so many seemingly one-and-done
mm-hmm.
freshmen. And that ball was...
It almost
did two full rotations of the rim. It's like a putt on a 18 at Augusta that does that. You remember it forever. But I was doing some research, and I'm going to write a column about this later this week. Duke was literally trying to defy history here. Because even the Duke 2015 squad that won the national championship with 3 one-and-dones and the Kentucky 2012 squad that won the national championship with a bunch of one-and-dones, they weren't nearly as dependent on freshmen as this group. This group, the four freshmen plus Alex O'Connell, who played a bit part but is also a freshman, accounted for over 70% of Duke's scoring this season. You have to go back to the Fab Five in 92, which accounted for about 75% of Michigan's scoring, to find a freshman class that dominant. Whereas the 2012 Kentucky squad, the 2015 Duke squad, even the 2015 Kentucky squad that went to the Final Four 38-0, they were all around 50% or less accounting for points and rebounds. Those teams had more significant junior, senior, and sophomore players than did this Duke team. And I thought you could see, particularly, and I don't mean to pick on him, I thought Wendell Carter look tentative against Kansas. You know, he gets the ball in the high post, and instead of just turning and naturally shooting, he would look, and then maybe he would shoot, or maybe he would pass. I just thought Duke's youth caught up to it.
Well, I'm looking at the rosters from those previous teams you'd mentioned. That 2015 team Duke had Marshall Plumlee. Captain was Quinn Cook, who'd been there for 4 years.
Oh, Emile Jefferson,
right.
Matt Jones.
And you're talking about a guy that was in the discussion as the number one overall pick, Jahlil Okafor, who's a transform. I mean, Bagley is a very, very good player. Mm-hmm. Okafor on that 2015 team, and then you go back to the 2012 Kentucky team, it's anchored by Anthony Davis, who is, you know, a top five player in the NBA now. He was, I mean, just a dominant, dominant player. And I don't remember, you would know better than me, than how Okafor was as a defender.
Awful.
But Davis was an unbelievable defender.
Yeah, now Okafor was a terrible defender. But that Kentucky team in 2012 had Terrence Jones and Darius Miller and Deron Lamb. And another player we forgot to mention on the Duke team, because he was kicked off the team halfway through the season, but Rashid Suleiman was a very important player. He was averaging like 8 points a game, mm-hmm. 15 games in when he got the boot. So that was a much more experienced team than people might recall.
And, you know, Justice Winslow had such a good tournament, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. As did, and
Grayson Allen had a great championship game, right?
Championship game, and Tyus Jones was most outstanding player of the Final Four, and that may have been his nudge to go ahead and go. He may have stayed another year had he not had that breakout Final Four.
But that Duke team that lost Saturday, I mean, Sunday. I mean, they were... That's a good basketball team and a very talented basketball team, and they lost in overtime. I mean, like you said, Grayson Allen, if that rattles in, you know, they're in the Final Four.
But you look at this Final Four, and it is a testament to experience. You look at the starting lineups for the four teams in their respective regional finals. Kansas started two seniors, a junior, a third-year sophomore, and a regular sophomore. Villanova, redshirt junior. Michigan has one freshman in the starting lineup, and Loyola has one freshman in the starting lineup. All these teams are really seasoned.
You would expect that out of Loyola.
Yes, but...
And Michigan. Now, Michigan hasn't been as bit by... You know, the early
and nor has Villanova.
No, yeah, right. Villanova has done a good job of keeping. Wright's done a good job of recruiting guys, and he doesn't. I mean, I'm sure I haven't followed recruiting over the last few years as I used to, but he's not generally signing, you know, the top five or six players in the country. He's not getting the one and done guys in as much.
Right. But you know, Devontae Graham, Kansas's best player, first team All American. He's a senior.
And who was their best player last year?
Right,
Frank Mason. Right.
Mm-hmm. From Petersburg.
He was a 4 year player, right?
Yep, absolutely. And Newman, who lit up Duke on Sunday, he's a redshirt sophomore, so he's in his third year.
And I like at times the kid from Ukraine. I'm not going to try to pronounce.
Yeah, I'm not going to pronounce his name either. But he's a senior.
Yeah, he hit some big shots.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
So and then as a bouquet,
he's a sophomore.
Yep. And a generally imposing presence. He is a big, large man.
He is all that.
All right, so that game was a classic. Lived up to what the hype I probably going into it, we thought it would be.
Yeah, it really was.
On the top half of that, we have Villanova advancing. We both picked them to win the national title.
Mm-hmm. Villanova's won all four of its games by double figures. That's
impressive. Yes, they have. And... just completely steady. I mean, Virginia, I think, is the most consistent team from start to the end of their conference tournament. But Villanova is, without question, the one that would contend them for the most consistent team.
Agreed.
They had very few slip-ups all season.
No, and contrast Villanova's path to San Antonio with, say, Kansas's. Because if Grayson Allen's shot goes in, Kansas is gone. Michigan needed that ridiculous buzzer beater in round two. Loyola had two buzzer beaters to survive the opening two rounds. Michigan's was against Houston, right?
Yep.
In the second round. So, you know, three of these teams are really fortunate to be in San Antonio, whereas Villanova just marched over everyone.
And they didn't have an opponent that was one you'd laugh at. Like, it wasn't, they didn't encounter a 13 seed in the Sweet 16 or somebody, you know, a double digit seed.
Right, it's not like the bracket broke.
No, they mowed through pretty solid basketball teams. They mowed through West Virginia, right? A West Virginia team that beat Virginia in December.
Yeah.
Or November. That may have been November, late November.
Yeah.
And Kansas's path wasn't easy either. I mean, they got a Clemson team that I was surprised by to be in that spot.
No, but Clemson played great against Kansas. Yeah. Well, I think the final margin was 6.
Yeah. And they played close. They played a competitive game against Seton Hall. So that matchup, and we'll get to that in a second. Let's bounce over. We haven't talked about Michigan a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
We did mention that Beilein, we both think, is a very, very good coach. That probably, I don't think, and maybe you talk to coaches, you run in those circles a little bit more than I do. I don't get the sense from a national media perspective that he gets the attention that he probably should.
No, he probably does. I think the respect and the regard are there, but because he's not
flashy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. He is the antithesis of, say, a Jim Valvano or a Calipari. He is not a showman. He is just workmanlike and goes about his business in a very classy way.
It's funny, those moments, man, that like that three-pointer Jordan Poole makes in the second round. He shouldn't have made that shot. That's a tough shot, and he gets his leg undercut
on
the shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's all spread eagle.
Crazy shot, right? And then they just boat race Texas A&M. A Texas A&M team that blew out a North Carolina team.
Yeah, I think people were really surprised. And just, you know, the power of the three. I mean, Michigan made, what, like 9 or 10 threes in the first half against Texas A&M? And then against Florida State 2 days later, couldn't buy a three. And that's what allowed the Seminoles to stay close.
It's funny when you watch the NBA, if you watch it, you know, certain teams like the Warriors and the Rockets have figured out that 3 points counts more than two. So mathematically, if you shoot enough of them, and you have NBA players that can make them, you're going to, if you have the shooters, you're going to do it. It doesn't work like that in college because you're not dealing with a bunch of pros, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there have been plenty of teams that have tried to do just that, to realize that from a metric standpoint, three counts more than two, let's take a lot of them and make 40%.
Well, yeah, that's where the stat effective field goal percentage comes into play.
They get past Texas A&M with relative ease, and they run into a Florida State team that has, between Florida State and Syracuse, and I think unexpectedly Clemson, I was shocked at how well some of these teams in the ACC played, considering what I had seen over the last month of the league play.
Yeah, I wasn't that surprised by Clemson. I was surprised that Clemson dispatched Auburn so easily in the second round. But I had Clemson going to the Sweet 16. One of the most shocking results of the tournament to me was Florida State beating Xavier in round two, just because I had seen Florida State last season as a 3 seed in the second round in Orlando, in its home state, get eviscerated by an 11th-seeded Xavier. And I don't know if they quit, but the final margin was 25 or 26. And it was uncomfortable sitting on press row because I'm sitting next to Florida State's AD and associate AD for basketball. And they're just, you know, they're deer in the headlights going, what are we seeing here? But Florida State reversed that result in a big way. And then, it advances past Gonzaga in a, you know, real quality victory, and then ran into Michigan and you know, Phil Kofer played well, and Terrence Mann had some moments, and they blocked some shots, but they couldn't make enough shots.
They lost six of their last 10 heading into this tournament. And they lost to Notre Dame without Bonzi Colson, right?
I saw my last two glimpses of Florida State before the NCAA tournament were, first of all, on TV, the last week of the regular season at NC State.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically didn't show up. Wolfpack won by at least 20.
20.
Yeah. And it was never close. And then in Brooklyn, at the ACC tournament, their first game, that it was an 8-9 game. I believe they were down 19 or 20 at halftime to Louisville. And it was never really in doubt afterwards. I think that they made a run in the second half. But, no, Florida State's the one team that really surprised me.
Well, I mean, I know from their seeding they weren't on a bubble team.
No,
but I thought just meh, like they're in, but we're not going to do anything.
No,
and then they get to the Elite Eight.
Yeah, first time since their second year in the ACC, which I believe was '93 with Sam Cassell and Bob Sur and Charlie Ward and mm-hmm. Pat Kennedy was a coach.
Yeah, so you're talking about ACC teams. We had four in the Sweet 65 in the Sweet 16?
Four ACCs in the Sweet 16 compared to only one last season, which was North Carolina. And two reached the Elite Eight and both lost.
But those four, if I had given you before this tournament started, you never would have guessed Florida State. You probably wouldn't have guessed Syracuse. Although Syracuse's defensive approach lends itself to doing well in this tournament.
Yeah, if you had told me four ACC teams were going to make the Sweet 16, I would have said Virginia, Duke, North Carolina, and Clemson.
Yeah. Not so much.
Nope.
Okay, matchups. We have Loyola and Michigan in the first tip-off, 6-something on Saturday.
Yeah.
How do you see that game going?
I like Michigan just simply because, and I know Loyola has beaten teams and programs with pedigree all along, but I just think that John Beilein, having so much tournament experience and having an experienced team, I think they will win. I just think they're a little too talented.
We talked about teams having, you know, the bracket breaking for them. Loyola has benefited greatly from getting, not seeing Cincinnati, not seeing Virginia or Arizona or mm-hmm. Kentucky. If we were ranking the four teams most likely to make the Final Four out of that bracket, those would have been the top four. I would have thought, you know, I would have put Kentucky and Arizona ahead of Tennessee in likelihood to get to the Final Four.
Yeah. They played. You know, a quality Nevada team in the Sweet 16, but no, the bracket fell their way, no question.
Do you still like Villanova?
Yeah, best team with the best player. I mean, I think the world of Jalen Brunson, and these are guys. A lot of these guys were on the team 2 years ago. They won the national championship, and DiVincenzo off the bench is really good. And I mean, Bridges is really good, and you know, in another year, Bridges might be a first or second team All-American. He made some All-American teams, not first team, but I mean, Villanova has in Bridges and Brunson. Villanova has arguably two of the top 15 players in the country. That's a pretty good foundation, and guys who, by the way, have tournament experience.
Yes. All right. So the Villanova and Michigan in the national championship game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Villanova wins for the second time in 3 years, and Jay Wright joins an exclusive club with multiple national champions.
What does that do to his legacy? There's a lot of guys that have one national championship. What does two do? What does that put you into?
It's going to get him in the Hall of Fame, I'll bet. That's big-time stuff. I mean, Bill Self's already in the Hall of Fame with one national championship.
Where does he, if you were putting together a list of top coaches in college basketball, both on what you see and what other coaches talk about, where does he rank, or where does he file into that list?
He's in the top 10, certainly.
And does winning a second title push him into even higher?
don't know if I put him in the top five or not, just because that top five is so good. But I mean, he's pushing. That's for sure.
Relatively young compared to some of the other guys on the block.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Yeah.
No, gray hair notwithstanding. I mean, Krzyzewski's in his 70s, but Self is relatively young too, and he's looking for title number two.
Yep. Well, you'll be there in San Antonio.
Leave Thursday.
We will have coverage from the tournament from you, so everybody should make sure they're following you on Twitter. They sure they listen to this podcast, they're already following you on Twitter.
One would hope so, and talk to Bernadette McGlade this week. Tomorrow, as a matter of fact, we're taping this Tuesday morning, but Wednesday I'm supposed to huddle with her over at the Atlantic 10 offices. Right here, a long three-pointer from our little headquarters. And she becomes a member of the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee next season. And that's really cool for her. Few know the game better than she. I mean, player, coach. I mean, a great player at North Carolina. I believe still the school's career rebounding leader. And it comes from a basketball family. I remember doing a profile on her a couple years ago, and she just talked about growing up in Jersey and being in the backyard with her sisters and just having at it. And they played against boys, and then she coached in the ACC, and then went into administration, first at the conference, in the ACC office, and at Georgia Tech, and was a supervisor to men's basketball, Bobby Crimmins. Was the coach then, and he speaks glowingly of Bernadette. Try to catch up with Tony Bennett down there. He's going to collect a few Coach of the Year awards. See what's on his mind. He was on his radio show last night and did some reflecting. Norm had some good tweets talking about what Bennett was saying.
Could you sum up some of the things that you heard or that he talked about last night?
Incredibly proud of the regular season, and that they will hang banners in JPJ to salute and recognize not only the regular season ACC championship that they won outright, but also the conference tournament championship, and how he told his players that people will be watching to see how you handle this defeat and how you comport yourselves. And do it the right way, and I think that's a great perspective. And I think one of his quotes was, "I love the NCAA tournament, and I hate the NCAA tournament." And he has every reason to feel both emotions.
Well, with Virginia's defeat in mind, maybe a future podcast we can go through and look at some of the teams that achieve greatness after going through something like they've gone through.
Sure.
It sounds like it would be an interesting case study at some point.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure, if you're not going to, I told someone else this, and I know this is not going to feel good for Virginia fans, but if you're going to lose, the story to redemption is much better the way they lost than, say, losing in the first game of the Sweet 16.
Right.
From our perspective, it certainly is a much more rich storytelling experience. But it also gives you, I would think, a lot more motivation if you're an athlete or you're a coach than, say, losing in the first weekend of the Sweet 16.
Yeah, and the glimpses that we've had of Kyle Guy and Ty Jerome their first 2 years at UVA, competitive doesn't begin to describe. I think they will be playing with an even sharper edge moving forward.
All right, well, everybody stay glued to Mr. Teal's Twitter account and
please
follow his coverage all weekend and into next week from the Final Four, and we'll come back next week and wrap it up.
Thanks, y'all.